Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. This is the last talk of the 2004 Rains Retreat. Tomorrow is the Pawarana Day. The time has gone very fast. How many more Rains Retreats have you got before you end up in the coffin? So it goes very quickly, and hopefully that many of you have progressed on this path. I don't really need to hope that, because this path I've seen over these many years, it does work. As long as people keep on this path, they keep on practicing, the mind becomes more peaceful, the peaceful mind becomes still, the still mind begins to see things, insights start to arise, the mind becomes more wise, the mind becomes softer and kinder. And that way there is this whole progress towards enlightenment. And you can see it happening, little by little, monks get closer and closer. You don't really need to really assess how far one has come, as long as that progress has been made. Because it's just like the simile of that old water pot, higher than a man's height, and there's water dripping in. You can see this progress being made. But you don't really know when that water pot will be full. It could be this evening, it could be in 20 years' time, you don't know. But all you can do is to make sure that water pot is filling up with wholesome qualities. And there's no leaks. So the unwholesome qualities can come in, or the wholesome ones can just leak away. As long as one protects one's practice, you can be sure and confident that one is on the road to Nibbana. And I think as one goes along this road, one's certainty increases. As one feels more peaceful, one feels wiser, one sees things which one never saw before. And what one sees, not only it makes so much sense, but it releases the mind from suffering. It gives peace, it gives happiness, it gives freedom. And the meaning of those words, peace, happiness and freedom, become very clear to you. So many people in the world, they may talk about peace, and they go to war to make peace. They talk about freedom, and they end up sort of controlling people. And they talk about sort of happiness, and all they really get is suffering in their lives. Well, the Aryas say is happiness. The ordinary people, the Putucana, say is suffering. You might even say, increase this saying, extend it, and say, well, the Aryas say is freedom. The Putucanas, the ordinary people, say is being in a prison. What the ordinary people are saying is being in is freedom. The Aryas say is being in a prison. Being in a prison of one's desires, defilements, ill will, criticism. What the Aryas say is peace. The ordinary people say is boring. And what the ordinary people say is peace. The Aryas say is not peace at all, it's just turmoil. So in that way that we understand by ourselves, little by little, as we progress on this path, what those things really mean. Peace, freedom, happiness. And that way that we know that we are getting somewhere in this path. This works, and we get wiser, kinder, more peaceful beings. And that gives us confidence. And that sort of confidence in the path carries on throughout the year. This retreat, so-called, it ends tomorrow, but this doesn't really end, as you all know, that the practice will have to carry on, maybe in a different form, but it's really up to you to learn how to take the silence of the mind into the world. It's not that hard. I have to do that all the time. Even during the Rains Retreat, still I am busy on the outside, but still I can just go into a cave, either the cave in the back of my hut or the cave in my mind when I'm traveling, to go into that cave and just to let go of all things and get peace and get bliss, get energy coming up. And of course, when you can do that, you understand how this practice, the Eightfold Path, leading to samadhi and leading to wisdom, that path actually protects you wherever you are. Sure, you learn it in solitude, and that solitude is almost the womb in which, you know, the fetus of wisdom, So the baby of enlightenment gestates until it eventually gets born into the Magan Palace. And once it gets born as a stream winner, then it will grow into maturity of the non-returner and arahat. And then will teach for the benefit of all sentient beings in this its last life. But it's just that gestating period. We know that it's going to sort of grow because we're cultivating these amazing qualities. And so as we cultivate these qualities, don't forget that that's the most important thing of one's monastic life. One didn't become a monk just to tour around and just to see this monastery or that monastery. One didn't become a monk just to go and meet your friends in monastic life. That can be done, but that's the secondary. The main reason, the core of being a monk, is to abandon the defilements, to free the mind, to gain those liberating insights based on the deep meditations. And once you have the priorities right, it doesn't matter where you are, what you're doing, how you're traveling, where you're going. And even if you're very busy giving talks like I am, you know, people are always on at you for some counseling or some problems. Even so, you can always recede into the silence of the mind. And it's very easy to do that. One just needs to learn how to press the letting go button. Just to learn from one's practice. Because even though that you've had ideal circumstances during this rains retreat, as ideal as it gets, sure there's been a few monks who have sickness and a bit more busyness than usual, still it's been so good to have all that time to sit alone, fully fed with delicious food, with great huts, walking paths, many of you, everything there, just left alone for so many hours of the day. Now even when you've had all that time, you haven't been using it 100%. Sometimes we waste time. What happens actually, we're outside of the rains retreat, we just don't have time to waste. Sometimes that's one of the practices which I have to follow. If I'm on the road, as it were, sort of teaching, sometimes you don't have much time for yourself. So when you do have time for yourself to meditate, you really make use of it. Sometimes that's an advantage of being busy, that when you do have an hour, you can't waste it. So you really get into it straight away. You really put the full attention, the full meaning, the full interest in what you're doing when you've just got that hour. And sometimes you know what it's like when you've got all day to meditate. Sometimes you don't put so much interest, effort, you don't put so much importance into every moment, because we get slack thinking we've got so much time. But when you haven't got much time at all, then you really are very mindful, very careful. You can't afford to make any mistakes or to be sloppy. So sometimes when you're in the period after the rains or you're traveling, sometimes it can actually enhance your practice. It's a different situation, but it can actually strengthen different aspects of the path. And that, of course, has been my experience, that you strengthen aspects of the path even when you're busy working or when you're laying bricks. There's so much of just the work which we do here that you can make use of for building up the muscles of meditation, to clearing the eyes of insight as one does the duties in the monastery. It's not as if that these are taking you away from the path. They have to be done, and you're making use of them in just a positive way. A lot of the path is just letting go of controlling, letting go of the doer. And of course this is what happens when you are asked by the workmaster to do this chore or that chore. You do it the way they want it to be done. You don't do it the way you want it to. You listen carefully to the instructions. If they tell you to drive slow, you drive slow. If they tell you to work fast, you work fast. If they tell you to do it this way, you do it their way. You don't do it your way. If you do it your way, you're just strengthening this doer, this inner controller, which blocks the meditation, which stops you getting deep states of mind and stops you gaining insights. So there is a letting go when you are being asked to do something. It's about active renunciation of your comfort, you know, when you have to go in and you get tired. There's all these wonderful ways where we can make use of the time after the rains retreat. And if we make use of that time wisely, it means by the time the next rains retreat arrives, we don't need to spend weeks getting back into it again. We are into it all year. And what are we into? We're into sort of letting go of greed, hate and delusion. We're into renouncing this inner controller which comes from the sense of self. We're letting go of this person who's fault-finding and critical, who judges other people and judges oneself. One develops a mind of peaceful compassion. That compassion, that kindness, is part of the path. When you say kind, that saying of mine, the door of my heart is open. No matter what one experiences, just have a contemplate where that leads to. It leads to letting go, to abandoning the doer. You often know in one's meditation that sometimes that the mind can't stay with the object, even when it's just the present moment, or the breath, or the beautiful breath, let alone the nimittas. Why? It's because one pushes it away. One causes it to go. Why is that? Because one hasn't really learnt fully what is meant by the door of my heart's open, no matter what you're experiencing. So no matter what, the unconditional mindfulness. So sometimes our mindfulness, our alertness, awareness, is not unconditional. We are mindful, but we want something more. We don't want this. We want to get deeper. We want this nimitta to stabilize, or we want this breath to become beautiful, or whatever it is. The mindfulness is not unconditional. It's got strings attached to it. There's a wanting there, a craving, a fuel for the disturbance called life. And so here, when we can practice just that degree of meditation on loving kindness, to understand what the door of my heart's open, no matter what you are, or what this is which I'm aware of now, you understand just how letting go can actually happen through metta, loving kindness. You understand just how that can take your meditation into very, very deep levels very quickly. It's a powerful tool. It's another way of doing this letting go. And of course it's a way which you can perfect at all times in your monastic life. Even if you have to drive the van again for the monks because there's a funeral, though my heart's open to that, no matter what it is. You become uncritical, non-fault-finding. Someone says something stupid to you, though my heart's open to that. You can call me whatever you like. You practice like Venerable Sariputta taught Rahula, just to be like the earth. When people shit on the earth never complains. Be like the fire, so that if it burns even rotten things, it doesn't complain. Be like the sun. You know, the sun will actually shine on good and bad people. Be like the wind. It blows the beautiful scent of flowers, and it blows the terrible stench of the compost pile just behind my hut onto my walking path. That's just the wind. So that means the meditation on those four elements was a way of not reacting to things, to be but like the earth, the wind, the floods. It just floods everything away, not just the good stuff, bad stuff as well. So like be sort of like this thing which is unconditional mindfulness. So whatever you're aware of, the door of my heart's open to this. Then you don't push things away. When you don't push things away, there's no sort of reaction, there's no trembling, there's no tightness to what's happening, either in one's meditation or in the world. One can learn how to flow with things, accept with things, be with things. And you know that you're flowing with things, you're accepting things, you're being with things. You know you're really letting go when the problem disappears, when the unwholesome dhammas decline and the wholesome ones increase. That's the sign of real loving kindness, real letting go, real unconditional mindfulness. you know it by its result. And so you have to sweep the roads. Can you do it with unconditional mindfulness? Just purely accepting what you need to do, without a complaint at all. Without the mind running away thinking of something else. If it does go thinking about something else or fantasizing, why? It's because it's not fully receiving what it's doing now. It wants to escape out of aversion, ill will, to the task at hand. Ill will, aversion to the task at hand, whether it's having to wait, whether it's someone's let you down, whether it's your body's letting you down with sickness, whether life is letting you down, disappointment, frustration, welcome to life. All of these things, can't we allow them to be when they can't be changed, which is most of the time? Can't we have this loving kindness, the door of my heart's open to you? Can't our mind be like the earth? You can pee on it if you like. The earth doesn't mind. If we can be like something like that, you can understand that in the world of coming and going, doing and actions, there's something which stays still, which doesn't react, which doesn't respond. That attitude of the mind, not to do. And if we can develop that in our daily life, of course you understand how easy it is to carry that attitude, that muscle of meditation, into one's formal practice. If one has been non-complaining, when one has been coming and going, working, travelling, doing things, writing letters, it means that when one sits down, one is also non-complaining. When one develops a mind which doesn't complain, imagine what happens. Non-complaining means much of the movement of the mind disappears. Complaining, fault-finding, is what moves the mind into action. It creates business for it. You all know that when we talk to each other, we talk about the faults, the differences of opinion, the things we disagree with, rather than all that we agree with. Complaints, fault-finding, finding what's wrong, takes up 99% of the work of the doer. When that is taken away, we accept we don't complain. We are unconditioned in our awareness rather than demanding. We are someone, as it says in the Metta Sutta translation, we are someone who's not demanding in nature, not even demanding in our meditation. We sit there, we don't demand peace, we don't demand happiness, we don't demand depth in our meditation, we don't demand enlightenment, because we're undemanding. Then we don't complain. Because we don't complain, the mind has got nothing to do. So it does nothing. And you've heard me throughout this whole range retreat focus on this path when you let go of the doer. Things settle down. Because the cause of movement has been undone. When the cause of movement has been undone, stillness comes. The breath is there and it doesn't move. Because you're unconditionally mindful of it. As you know, when even with me, the first time I watch the breath, it's always uncomfortable for a few seconds. But I accept that. And I allow it to be. Sometimes it's fast and it goes deeper. Sometimes it's slow. When it's slow, I don't say, why are you slow today, stupid mind? When it's fast, I don't say, ah, that's the real mind. It is at peace with both functions of the mind. These are just causal experiences. Causal because they come from all sorts of influences. Why sometimes your mind gets into samadhi quickly? Why sometimes it goes slowly? Why it doesn't at all sometimes? Nothing to do with you, it's causes. You may have been busy, you may be tired, you may have a sickness, you may have hay fever, you may have just not slept properly. All of these causes, you can't fight those. So why do you try and fight the results which are consequent on those causes? We don't fight anything if we're a real Buddhist. The Buddhist way is a way of peace, a way of kindness. Just a way of being non-judgmental, of acceptance. You imagine sort of the Buddha in front of you, the compassionate one, the great teacher of those who are willing to be trained. And if one can allow that teaching to be one who is willing to be trained, the Sangha, the coalition of the willing, this willing to be trained under the Buddha, that's who you really are. So allow yourself to be trained by these teachings. Just let go and let the Dharma just permeate and soak you through. And so that there's no part of your being which is not permeated with the beautiful freeing Dharma of the Lord Buddha. And that way these Dharmas of being like the four elements, of being non-reactive, that Dharma of kindness, compassion, being someone who says, the door of my heart's open to this. Especially in your meditation, when you're sitting still. When you're tired, when sloth and torpor is there, door of my heart's open to you, sloth and torpor. I'm letting you be. That was a great trick in my meditation, which I talked about, I think, in the first talk here. Just to be able to overcome that dullness by letting it be. It's powerful. Because sometimes that dullness, it tricks us into, come on, fight me. It's just like this person who just shapes up, come on, come on, fight me, fight me, fight me. And too often you get caught in that, fighting back. And of course when you fight back, you always lose. You're not following the path of a Buddha who just knows without fighting. You're following the path of the controller. It enhances your sense of self when you fight. You become the hero according to the world rather than the hero according to the Dhamma. So here that we learn just how to practice these beautiful techniques, the techniques which the inclinations of the mind, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whatever is happening to you, even you're sick and dying, so the door of my heart's open to this sickness, death. Allow it to be. Of course you can't do that if you've always been a controller, in charge of your life. I'm not going to allow someone else to tell me what to do, the sense of self says. And at the time you're deaf, I'm not going to let death tell me what to do. You complain at your last breath. And of course, that leads to birth in the lower realms. Certainly not freedom from birth. And when you've developed the attitudes of acceptance, kindness, peacefulness, making peace with every moment in your meditation, just as you make peace with every moment in the life outside of your meditation. When you get in the car to go to a funeral, you make peace with this. When someone is late, you make peace with that. When someone chants out of tune, you make peace with that. When they do something stupid, you make peace with it. It's wonderful when you don't have to be the senior monk. Sometimes I make peace with it and think maybe I shouldn't, I'm supposed to do something. I don't know, maybe I'm not good as an abbot. Maybe I should be more of a controller, more the Führer rather than the, I don't know what I am. But whatever it is, this is the way I've practiced my meditation. You do have this wonderful sense of acceptance of all the people who in this monastery and come to this monastery. It's a wonderful sense of being at peace with them. If you're at peace with what you're watching in your mind, what you're aware of, if you have this unconditioned mindfulness, then actually what you see becomes peaceful. It's as if you add the peace into your world. But if you have a very critical mind, a very negative mind, a fault-finding mind, you add that more criticism, more fault, more negativity into the world. And you can see that in people out there in the lay life who add so much negativity to their life. They live in this very, very critical world where nothing is right, where everything is wrong, where there's so many things to fix that they can never rest in peace. How can you rest? It's only when one realizes that this is all caused. We're not going to add any more negative causes to samsara, at least not the samsara that we live in. We can be at peace with things. We can be more accepting, more kind, more loving kindness, more gentleness. And when you do that, the life outside the retreat time is very peaceful and happy. And the life in retreat time is also very peaceful and happy. The same attitudes create the peace and happiness, the freedom in both. That's why the Buddha could work so hard. Even when he was talking and teaching, helping others. The same movement which creates the letting go of the world. The same movement when he did his duties to the world was always in operation. A constant mindfulness in the sense of a constant letting go, renouncing, giving up. Even when he was laying down the rules of the Vinaya, there was still the letting go, the disengaging, making peace with his duties, doing what had to be done without complaints or control. When one understands that, one understands why those monks who say the range retreat outside the range retreat, fundamentally they are the same. And it means that you're not really concerned about tomorrow. You're not really worried about, okay, now the range retreat finishes, now I can read all the newspapers, magazines, now I can just indulge. Letting go doesn't mean indulging. Those of you who think, okay, if my retreat finishes tomorrow, then I'll let go. You're letting go of the wrong things if it's indulging. Path continues on until the end when you become fully enlightened. Till one is that, there's always work to be done. And that work is one of renunciation, one of kindness, one of acceptance, one of peace, one of letting go, one of disengaging. Disengaging from the world means disengaging from that which creates the world. The house builder, the samsara builder, craving, doing, making, building, complaining. Just, you can imagine, sometimes I used to do this, sometimes I used to imagine what it would be like to be enlightened. And the imagination is very powerful because it can create little worlds within worlds. Imagine what it's like to be fully enlightened. In this few moments, have no craving, no wanting, no desire to be. And in those few moments, you can get a taste of what the path is. And you can actually see so many burdens, so much work just disappears. Too often in the world, we think that the only way you can complete the work is by doing it. For those of you who are work masters, those of you who build, you know that that sort of work never finishes. The work in the world goes on and on and on. This monastery, the external monastery, will never be finished. There will always be more huts to build, more roads to put in, more things to paint and fix up. The external monastery will never be finished. But you can complete the inner monastery any time, any moment, and have really done with it. That's getting rid of the doer, the maker inside, which makes all these plans, which makes all these arguments, which makes all this conflict. The conflict maker, the arguer, that inside of you, which does all this stuff, which spoils the stillness and peace of your inner world. Look at that. Why is it that when you have your retreats, you've got nothing to do? Why, when you've got nothing to do, the mind always finds something to do? Find something to think about. Find something to plan. Find something to complain about. Find something to fantasize about. Why does your mind do that? You've got nothing to do. Why not do nothing? Because it goes against the grain of our conditioning. We've been sort of taught, conditioned, brought up, brainwashed to be the great controllers, especially in the Western world, where technology, science, progress, control has really messed up everything. We just can't be anymore. We always have to be going somewhere. Instead of going somewhere, we just stop. Just be where we are. Life in the present moment. Life when the absence of the doer creates this beautiful stillness. The stillness of the mind, which isn't going anywhere. Just staying in the moment with whatever's happening. Start with whatever's happening. And because you're making peace with whatever's happening, it's as if the peace from the knower goes into the known. As if because you're knowing with peace, what you know becomes peaceful. You're putting peace into this, whatever you're experiencing. You're putting stillness into the experience. When you put stillness into the experience, everything becomes so still and peaceful and lovely and quiet. You don't need to change anything. That old simile of the lotus, the most dirty, dingy, unpromising lotus in the lake, has always got the jewel of Dharma in it. You don't need to seek out the most perfect lotus looked at from the outside to begin your work. Even this messy, dirty, hopeless, depraved, delinquent little lotus of your mind right now. It's not that bad, but just exaggerating. That's more than good enough. To stay with that. Make peace with that. Be kind. Little mind of mine. Look, it's almost the end of the range retreat. What have I done? Slept. Slept a lot. What have I done? Thought a lot. Planned a lot. What have I done? That little old delinquent mind of yours. Be kind to it. Say, little mind, I don't know what you've been doing all this 89 days of the range retreat so far. The door of my heart's open to your mind. And then you start to see all these petals start to open out. They open out all by themselves. It's as if they're afraid of your mindfulness. That's why they close up. When they have a little bit of kindness, a little bit of friendliness, they open up to you. The meditation on loving kindness. Little lotus of my mind. This may be dirty and really unpromising, but you're good enough. You're my friend. Door of my heart's open to you. Just that little lotus smiles. Layer after layer. Boop, 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 boop. All opening up. You find your mind becomes beautiful. You go to the deep levels inside the lotus flowers so quickly. If you really know loving kindness, it's a very fast way to get into deep meditation. If you know it, if you do it properly. Because it's got that sense of beauty and energy together. The energy of non-doing. The energy of non-reacting. Just of acceptance, of letting go, of peace, relinquishing, freedom, contentment. It's very powerful in those areas. So do loving kindness on your little mind. It just opens up. Oh, this is so easy and so beautiful. That ease and beauty, the effortlessness and the piti sukha just grows and grows and grows. You understand what we mean? And you can do that with anything in your life, no matter what you're doing. You have to go to Sydney and give all these talks. You have to sort of go and say the same old things again. And go and visit people in the hospital. And don't get any sleep. And sort of work out people's problems, and people right at the very end, they know this is your last talk, so they squeeze the last drop of juice out of you because they won't see you again until the next time. They don't realize you have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get your plane to come back to Perth. They keep you up to 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. If anyone could should complain, it's me. But I refuse. I refuse to complain. Let that be. Door of my heart's open. I can always sleep on the plane or sleep somewhere else. I remember this monk who used to sit up on the Dhamma seat, used to go to sleep when he was giving a talk. Now, I wish I could do that. That would really show that really showers letting go. He would sit there, just go to sleep, didn't care about all the monks listening to him. And of course, we didn't dare leave and go away, because every now and again he'd wake up again and continue talking. He was really asleep, you can tell that. So he used to go on for hours that way, having sort of power naps during his talk. I'm probably too proud to do that. Actually, probably too scared, I'd sort of fall off the Dhamma seat. There are things at the back and the side to stop him falling off. Maybe should have put a seatbelt on the Dhamma seat just in case. But anyway, just be kind to yourself when you make mistakes, when you do stupid things. Because when you're kind to yourself, the most stupid, unpromising thing can become sort of the seed of jhanas. I know that because sometimes some most unpromising states of mind I've started off with. You know, you think that really when you sort of close your eyes and start, there's no way in the world can you start from this and get into the deep meditations, but you can if you have the right attitude. Any old lotus is good enough to start with if you know what to do. Just renounce, let go, be at peace, make peace with the moment, allow mindfulness to be still on what you're experiencing. Allow mindfulness to be still on what you're experiencing. It means unconditional mindfulness. A mindfulness which is not demanding in nature, which doesn't want anything. It's just so happy just to have the opportunity of watching something, whatever it is, and giving it peace, giving it kindness. It's always a case, you know, if you see someone and smile at them, they usually smile back. If your mindfulness smiles at whatever you're experiencing, what you're experiencing smiles back too. What you're knowing becomes beautiful, becomes attractive, and allows the mind, mindfulness, and the object to engage. To engage in this dance of stillness, becoming more and more peaceful, more and more fun. Once you get the hang of this, the mind, mindfulness, knowing, kindness, letting go, they just play together as you go deeper and deeper into the lotuses of your mind. And soon this beautiful nimittas come up, and you're kind to the nimitta. Nimitta, if you want to come up, great, that's fine. If you're too busy and want to go somewhere else, that's fine too. Off you go. It's beautiful kindness and friendliness rather than grabbing hold of this nimitta. Nimitta at last, you're not going to go. Now you come, I'm going to hold you. I'm going to sort of chain you, imprison you in my mindfulness. Of course it runs away straight away and will not come and visit you for a long time because you're scary. You're violent. You just don't know how to treat these very, very refined and civilized nimittas. You're a barbarian. It's true. That's what nimittas probably think if they had minds. You know, you're barbarian. As soon as I come up and say hello, you just grab hold of me and just squash me. And don't let me go. Never going to visit you again. Go visit Ajahn Brahm. He's kind. When you actually understand what I'm saying, you understand how to deal with these things. How you deal with life is how you deal with these nimittas. How you deal with jhanas when they come up. So you get these ping-pong jhanas when you first start out. Just come up and you just grab hold of them and you aren't ready for me, says the jhana. You just don't know what to do. You're just too controlling, just too attaching, just too much wanting. You don't know just how to let things be and be friendly and not complain. You don't know how to be at peace with power. When you learn how to be at peace with these powerful things, and with kindness, you can come if you want. You don't have to come if you don't want. Whatever you want to do is fine by me. You're just a soft and malleable, adaptable. Isn't that beautiful saying after the fourth jhana? The mind is soft and malleable, adaptable. You can see that's the result of starting off in this soft, malleable, adaptable, workable way. You're not sort of stiff like gold which has defilements in it. Pure gold without those impurities, you can bend it, you can stretch it, because it's just so pure and bendable. So the result, you know, the mind after fourth jhana, the result of that should actually show you the means as well, the way. You don't sort of get to that softness, that malleability, that workability of the mind by making it stiff and tough to begin with. You actually practice malleability, softness, bendability, adaptability from the very start. You build up those qualities. You build them up prior to jhana, they're strengthened in jhana, and after the fourth jhana, that's what you're left with. Beautiful, soft, bright, brilliant, powerful, adaptable, malleable mind. That's why you can just suggest to that mind, "Mind, just go get a past life, please." It runs off just like this well-trained doggy. You know, when you set it to go and catch the get the paper, it runs off, wagging its tail. And it comes back with a newspaper at your feet, wags its tail, looks upon you with its big bright eyes, just like these well-trained dogs. Just like the well-trained upataks. You ask them a cup of tea, and they run off, get you a cup of tea or some sugar, and they come back with these big bright eyes. If they had a tail, they'd be wagging it. Those are the upataks I like. And those are the minds I like. Soft, malleable, workable. Without a complaint at all. Just so happy just to do something for you. Imagine a mind like that, just so happy, just waiting to do something for you. A mind which is soft, which knows what loving kindness is, what is peaceful, what is not defiled and hard, which is malleable and soft, forgiving, kind, adaptable, able to bend to the circumstances of life. Bending to the time of the retreat, enjoying the solitude, bending to the time of work, you know, being willing to sort of help out, bending to the time of travel, when you've got to go to new places, new monasteries, adapt to new surroundings. A mind which is adaptable, bendable, soft, malleable, like pure gold. That is our goal. That is our means to that goal. If you're hard, of course, you can never get to those soft states of mind. If you're someone who's controlling, you can never actually get. You'd always, if you're a controller and you're an upatak, I ask you, "Can you go and get me this?" You say, "No, I'll get it later on, I'm busy." "Or, can you sort of please help me?" "No, I don't feel well today." "Can you go and get this for me?" "No, get it for yourself." Isn't that sometimes what we tell our mind? Mind, can you do this? You say, "No, too busy, no, too tired, no, too hot, no, too cold," whatever. Don't be hard, be soft. Be someone who never complains. Be someone who has kindness. Be someone who has wisdom. Someone who can adapt to all situations and circumstances. Even your sickness and death, even when things all go wrong, then you know the path into deep meditation. You know, just whatever you're experiencing, you allow it to be, and the problem disappears. The harshness of it goes, the pain is softened. And that way the mind gets into these beautiful, blissful states when one is meditating. And the mind gets into this beautiful, blissful happiness when it's travelling on the plane going somewhere. The mind gets into this beautiful, beautiful, blissful happiness when you're asked by the workmaster to actually to go and do a job. You feel so privileged to be able to help, to be able to serve. "Thank you, workmaster, for asking me." You have this soft, kind, beautiful mind. You can know it is wholesome, it is kusala. You can feel that. It's something which leads to peace, which leads to joy, which leads to freedom, which goes against the stream of the world, which is always demanding and complaining. Isn't that a beautiful mind? Isn't that a mind which we should all develop? Isn't that a mind which the Buddha would have praised? Isn't that a mind which leads to nibbana? Of course it is. Try it out and see. If you haven't got nibbana yet, if you haven't got the deep meditations yet, check out these things. The
the softness, the peace, the kindness of the mind. And once you check those out and you develop them, in the retreat, outside of the retreat, while you're coming and going, the world might be coming and going, but the mind is soft, still, at peace and free, wherever you are, whatever time, whatever happens. So that's the last talk of this Rains Retreat. But I'm sure there'll be another talk coming soon in a meditation hall near you.